and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast where Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts discuss international issues of the day. My name is Warwick Jones, and I am the Australian Federal Police Visiting Fellow at the Institute. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of these lands and recognising their leaders past, present and emerging. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Assistant Commissioner Nigel Ryan from the Australian Federal Police. Nigel has been a police officer in the AFP for over 25 years. He has a wide and varied career, including coordinating the AFP's response to the MH17 disaster in the Ukraine, implementing the federal government's National Anti-Gang Squad initiative, and managing sensitive investigations. Nigel is a graduate of the Defence and Strategic Studies course at the Australian Defence College and has studied in the UK. He is a recognised expert in the fight against drug crimes and organised crime. Nigel is currently the Assistant Commissioner Crime Command and is responsible for leading the fight against transnational, serious and organised crime in Australia. Recently, Nigel was one of the AFP leaders of the Operation Ironside, a multinational operation that has led to one of the most significant disruptions of organised crime the world has seen. In this operation, law enforcement officers from a number of countries combined to arrest over 800 suspects and seize over 32 tonnes of drugs. Here in Australia alone, nearly 300 offenders have been charged, 139 weapons and $50 million worth of cash seized. Nigel, welcome. And perhaps let's start at the beginning. How does a boy from Lockhart in the Riverina end up joining the AFP and ultimately leading an operation such as Ironside?
Yeah, thanks, Warwick, and thank you very much for having me on today. A bit of an interesting story about how I ended up in the Federal Police. I get a bit of a giggle out of it still now because there's actually a friend of mine who decided it would be a good idea to try and put an application in for the Federal Police for me. I saw it as an opportunity to take a day off school. I was at boarding school at the time, and it was a day off school for me. So I literally used an opportunity just to wag school and did the test and got through. But then when I got through the testing, I realised that I was actually too small to be a police officer. I didn't make the height for weight requirement. So when I had to do my medical exam, I ended up drinking 5 litres of water before I went in for the examination, which sort of got me over the line in terms of the height for weight ratio, but kept me on the toilet for most of the rest of the day.
Amazing. And I'm glad that we don't have that sort of requirement any longer to put people through that sort of suffering. So tell us about some of the jobs you've done along the way that have got you where you are today.
Yeah, Warwick, I sort of started my career in ACT policing. I spent a long time working as a detective there, a lot of time working as a drug detective and general crime, armed robberies, homicides, sexual assaults and those types of things. So I spent a good part of my career in the ACT police and then transitioned across to the national side of the AFP, worked in various jobs a number of times, working in the Office of the Commissioner once as a media advisor. And I also, as you alluded to in the intro, I was responsible for setting up the National Anti-Gang Squad. I've also worked in the International Command, and I've also worked in our professional standards. I was Chief of Staff for a period of time. Now I'm obviously working as the Assistant Commissioner of the Crime Command, which is made up of a lot of interesting parts of the organisation, including our covert and technical operations, our intelligence, our transnational offshore disruption teams with intel, our human sources and our undercover program, and I also have the Crime Command more generally.
And you did some time as an undercover officer. How did that shape you, and what did you learn about criminals from that period of time?
I did do a fair bit of time as an undercover operative. I spent time offshore in organised crime networks, basically as a drug dealer. The thing about that, it's completely terrifying. I'd say that from the outset. It definitely has a shelf life in terms of how long you could do that sort of work because of the sort of impacts it can have on you as a person. The thing about being in those sort of networks, the thing that amazes me is how much greed and wealth there is in dealing drugs. Like it's absolutely incredible. And I think what we've seen in Operation Ironside only reinforces that in my view, that there's a lot of greed in these types of things. And it's also a very, very violent environment to be in as well.
We'll talk a bit more about Ironside shortly, but I kind of want to talk about the threat of organised crime to Australia. And you recently made comments in the media that organized crime needs to be treated as a national security threat and needs to be taken as seriously as terrorism. Could you sort of explain those comments you made?
Yeah, sure. Look, the thing about terrorism is that it's right in our psyche and it really, really scares our community, and rightfully so. It's a terrible, terrible criminal act, and we're right to be very frightened about the prospect of terrorist attacks and terrorist events. And so the way that we react to that is really quite heightened. And I think the thing about organized crime is because it's not so in your face, you don't really realize that you're seeing it when you do see it, but the effects and the outcomes of organized crime are very, very significant. You look at the safety and security and the trust of our citizens, the prosperity of businesses and economies, integrity of our institutions, particularly, you know, legitimate supply chains. You've got things where we're creating false economies. There are people in our societies being harmed. There are communities being destroyed by drugs. You know, literally, there are people being murdered on the streets. And we sort of don't give it much thought. I sort of described this as a casual indifference to organised crime, but the actual impacts on our community and on Australians is very, very significant. You look over the course of the last 20 years, and there's been more than 4,000 deaths that attributed just to methamphetamines alone. So that's a significant impact, and you don't have to look very far to know someone who has been affected by someone in a drug addicted state, whether it's people driving under the influence and they end up and kill innocent people, and or people being assaulted on the streets, frontline workers, people in hospital. The effects of drugs in our society is significant, and that is TSOC. And that's why I think it's really a national security threat, because of the harm it does to our people and our communities.
So what do we need to do to make people more aware of this threat, to get more done to counteract some of these threats?
Well, it's a real difficult one, Warwick, because whilst ever there remains the ability to get the profits that organised criminals do from selling drugs into our country, it will remain a problem and it will remain a threat. And sadly to say, Australians are amongst some of the highest abusers of drugs in the world, and they pay the highest amount of money for drugs in the world. So organised criminals are systematically targeting Australia for that very reason. And you have a look at some of the statistics across the last decade or so, and you know, the amount of drug use, particularly with methamphetamine in Australia, that it's more than doubled. The number of users in Australia has more than doubled in the last decade.
We might loop back to that. Let's talk about Ironside itself, because it highlights a number of these issues. And I'm kind of interested in the genesis of Ironside. How did it start? And then if you could tell us a little bit about how it was brought together and coordinated so effectively internationally.
This is all about encrypted communications, okay? So for organized crime to work, there are a number of elements. It's like lighting a fire. You have to have the ability to communicate. You have to have the logistical or facilitating parts to make it happen. And then it's all about the money. So those three elements are really, really crucial in how we fight organized crime. And in the case of Ironside, we had a very, very unique opportunity to actually seize upon a newly developed application that was being developed. And we were able to work with the FBI to create some technical fixes to allow us to access, decrypt, and read encrypted communications lifetime. So it hasn't sort of just happened quickly. The AFP's been working in the encrypted communications space for about 15 years now. We've got some extremely intelligent people who are working on this stuff. It sort of blows my mind what they're able to do some days. It was sort of a perfect storm in some ways. So that we had this application that was being developed, which was called Anom, and we had just come on the back of taking down Phantom Secure in 2018 with the help of the FBI and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So it actually left this gap in the market in terms of encrypted comms that could be used for organised crime. So we literally seized upon that opportunity and the circumstances that it presented. And we partnered up with the FBI to basically create our own telco. I guess the rest is sort of history in terms of what we were able to achieve.
Though I guess in terms of the rest was just history, it takes a lot of work to build those relationships of trust with agencies like the FBI and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. How does the AFP go about establishing those sort of relationships? I guess, you know, some of these are longer term relationships, but how do we work and maintain those relationships internationally?
I guess we're the envy of a number of foreign law enforcement agencies in terms of the footprint that we have in our international command. You know, the AFP is in 30-odd countries. We have a lot of people that are deployed offshore for liaison purposes. And it's those long-lasting relationships. We've been in some of these relationships for more than 30 years. We've been in this space internationally for a long time. Part of it is about having a long time to develop those relationships. And from there, you need the right people with the right skills and the right drive, I guess, to be able to do this sort of stuff. And that's what we saw in this instance, where we were able to partner up with the FBI based on our longstanding relationship and the unique set of circumstances it presented.
And then you brought in a number of other countries as well. Did that represent any challenges, or was that relatively easy to achieve?
There were a number of challenges that we did have, and that this is unique in some ways because we were sort of caught in a position where we weren't able to really collaborate the way that we would wanted to because of the operational security that was based on this job and this technology. So that in its own right creates problems because, you know, I've worked in a lot of different jobs in policing, and the only way that we can do it is in that joint space. So having partners on board is a crucial element to fighting organised crime. So in this circumstance, we more or less had this platform running close to 3 years, and then it came to the end of its life when the FBI had some legal authorities that were coming to expiration, and that sort of signaled the time where we had to go overt on this job. So we unfortunately were caught in a position where we had 2 months to cram all this work into some sort of operational outcome, and we described it as doing 20 years of policing in 2 months, and that was what it was like. So the ability for us to quickly and agilely move into that space where we could get both domestic and international partners on board was absolutely incredible. I think by the end of it, we had about 18 countries involved, and domestically here we had all of our state and territory partners and some of our other Commonwealth law enforcement partners involved as well, so that we could mobilise the troops and make the best of what we had with the information in terms of the resolution.
That's quite an amazing statement, you know, doing 20 years of policing in 2 months. I'd be interested if you could tell us a little bit about the people involved in this that were putting that much work into making this a successful operation. What kind of drives them, and, you know, how do you lead these people?
Some of these people are so dedicated, you know, in their own right. If they're in private enterprise, they could be getting paid a whole lot more money than they are getting paid here, unfortunately. But it's that dedication and that sense of justice and wanting to be part of something that makes something better that sort of drives these people. And this job sort of sat in the AFP for many years without hardly anyone knowing about it. And there's a small group of people who drove it, and they used to have a whiteboard down in their little dungeon, they called it. And it had a condensed version of a quote from Marcus Aurelius, and it was something about the obstacle becomes the way. And, you know, that was really the driving piece there, that the encrypted comms was the obstacle. So they actually became the obstacle, and it's quite an incredible story. And, you know, they're obviously quite driven to succeed in that regard. I think in terms of leading these people, I spoke to a number of these guys before we went to resolution, and knowing what we were about to embark upon, it was a good moment for me to sort of reflect on that as a leader and think about the people that were doing these jobs. And I said to them that when you hand great people possibility, they do great things. And that's exactly what we saw in this instance. And I think the other piece that was really important to me was that, you know, it's really amazing what can be accomplished when you don't care who gets the credit for it. And that was the real collaborative piece where we were able to sort of get everyone together. We were able to assemble close to 4,500 law enforcement members in Australia to execute, you know, 700 odd warrants over a couple of days, which has never been seen before, and I doubt we'll ever see again. So, yeah, look, it's a really, really interesting time, and like I said, completely unprecedented. And so we sort of had to make the script up as we went.
But incredible amount of effort obviously goes into making sure that the credit is shared, And, you know, so, 'cause sometimes between, you know, state and federal, there can be that sort of rivalry, et cetera. And it's a real credit to the work that you and the team did that that didn't occur. I want to turn now to what does Ironside mean for Australia, and what additional things have we learnt about organised crime as a result of being able to listen in for the last 3 years?
Yeah, look, I think it's really important to point out, Warwick, that what we did with Ironside, that as a platform represents, by our estimation, about 10% of the criminal environment that we see in Australia. And of everything that we were able to capture across Ironside, we're only, at this point in time, only been able to reconcile about 15% of the criminal offending. So if you sort of extrapolate that out, we sort of are quite stunned at the size of organised crime in Australia. So, you know, it's the other 90-odd percent of organised crime that we're not getting a look at, or that we're not able to fully focus on for various reasons. That's the bit that really concerns me. And it concerns me from the point of view of what it does to it, to our nation and our people and our communities. So that's a real concern for me. I think what we're looking at now is the what next, what we do off what we still have on this platform, and how we look at attacking that other 90% in a way that sort of makes life better for all Australians.
As I'm listening to what you're saying there, it makes you realise how insidious this problem is. But as part of that sort of idea you mentioned earlier to do with national security, it really does demonstrate in terms of not just raw costs, but it shows in terms of the impact it's having on people, but also our systems. And as we move into a more uncertain world post-COVID, we start to see other things playing out, like countries that, you know, may think that they can influence negatively our trust and confidence in our government. So I'm kind of wondering, is there a bigger perspective to the impact of organised crime as well?
Yeah, look, it's completely insidious. It's everywhere we go, but like I said, I just don't think it gets the attention that it needs to get. And if I can give you a bit of an indicator there, Warwick, we've estimated for a few years that Australians consume about 11 tonnes of methamphetamine every year. And the concerning piece for me is that at the time that we went overt for the resolution of Operation Ironside, we can factually identify that there were 10 tonnes of drugs on the water heading to Australia within the space of a month. So there are countries that obviously are targeting Australia because of the profit that can be made from these drugs. And we obviously work very closely with a lot of those source countries that are targeting us to do what we can. But you are right, there are other, I guess, things that are being targeted within our national security type of setup that we should be equally concerned about. And obviously the AFP does a lot of work in that space as well.
In one of the articles on the operation, it was said that Ironside's success was due to ingenuity by law enforcement rather than any additional government resourcing or any meaningful change in the drug demand supply equation that makes Australia one of the most profitable drug markets in the world. I assume the AFP doesn't need nuclear submarine levels of investment to help fight some of these issues. But however, what would help you to do your job better in making Australians safer?
I'd never be one to say that we couldn't do without more resources, because the fact of the matter is we could have another 500 investigators working in the organised crime space and it would still be an issue for us. What I would say, though, Warwick, is that there are elements now with the way that technology is changing. A really crucial part of what we have to do is ensure that our legislation keeps up to speed with what is changing in the environment so that we can adapt and be dynamic and move towards what we can do. And, you know, recently there was a Surveillance Legislation Amendment Act, which had gone through Parliament, which we're very grateful for. Those types of things make it better and easier for us to do our job. And I think that's the challenge and the key, is to ensure that we've got the right legislation and that we've got the right technology and ability to do things to sort of tackle these problems.
So on the subject of legislation, you'll often hear people critical of some of that legislation, like the Toller Act, et cetera, where people feel that some of their civil liberties have been impinged upon by the new legislation, which gives police greater powers. What would you say in response to that sort of line of argument?
I get the whole privacy issue and that type of thing, but I mean, the AFP is oversighted by a number of different agencies that make sure that we use this legislation in a manner that's not impinging on people's rights in particular. The thing that I would say though, Warwick, and you look at Ironside as an indicator, we're talking about a platform that was used exclusively for organised crime. This wasn't an application or a communications platform that was your wife asking you to pick up 2 litres of milk and a loaf of bread on the way home. This was all about commercial scale drug dealing, commercial scale money laundering, and violence at a rate that we've never seen. That we have people that were ordering assassinations across this platform. So in terms of impinging on people's human rights, you only need to look at Ironside to see that this is not impinging on people's rights. This is actually the police doing exactly what the community would expect from them in terms of trying to keep our nation and our citizens safe.
So that relationship with the community is absolutely critical for effective policing. Has events such as COVID-19 impacted on that relationship with the community in either a positive or a negative sense?
I think it's a very difficult space to be in terms of policing, particularly when you are tasked with implementing legislation that in some ways does impinge on people's rights. And you look at some of those principles of policing in terms of what the public values and how much the community has to give up in terms of their liberties, that can affect the legitimacy of police. And, you know, that is a concern. And I think you don't have to look very far in Australia to see some of the backlash against legislation and restrictions that have been put in place by governments and how police are in the middle of the enforcement of that and what that does to the trust that people have in police more generally.
For the AFP, that connection to community is slightly more complex because the AFP is often seen a little bit further away than state police. How is the AFP going about ensuring it remains really connected to the Australian community?
A lot of people wouldn't know what the AFP does, I guess, is the first point that I'd make. And it's much more the state police that you see on a more day-to-day basis that has that closer connection to community. But Commissioner Kershaw has come from a background there and has been very strong in terms of voicing his thoughts about how we need to be connected to community. And I think we've been doing that quite successfully, particularly with how we're trying to communicate with the community and talk about what the impacts of what the AFP does for the community are. So I think that's been relatively successful. But the other thing that we can't lose sight of is that we work in the joint space with all our state and territory partners all the time. So in the joint counterterrorism space, the National Anti Gangs, you know, child protection, joint task force arrangements, we're working with our state and territory partners all the time. And, you know, that's where there's that added benefit and the force multiplier that we have in terms of protecting the community.
Lastly, I sort of want to turn to the deeper challenges of a job like Ironside. And I know that there was much discussion around the ethical issues about monitoring potential threats to life that you were picking up in the transmissions that you were monitoring. How do you handle these challenges personally when you've got that sort of real deep ethical decision? And what sort of oversight is in place for a job like this to ensure that harm is minimised?
That was a really tough one, and policing is a risky business and there are risks that you do have to take, but we would never have put anyone in the position where there was a risk to their life that something could be carried out. So we were very fortunate in Ironside that some of our clever people here at the AFP were able to leverage off artificial intelligence and the machine learning type angles to set up systems that were able to identify any threats to life that were posed. Originally, you would have seen that there were 21 threats to life that we extinguished. We've actually had a review on some of that as well. And the threats to life that we prevented over the course of Ironside were 29. And I'm very glad to say that no one was actually killed during that almost 3-year period. But we were able to work with our state and territory partners and provide that information to them so that we could put in place different strategies to prevent anyone being killed as a result of what we'd heard across the platform. But you're right, you know, there are things that play in our mind and you have to make very calculated assessments about what you will and won't do. And like I said, I'm glad to say that nothing untoward happened in terms of anyone being killed on our watch.
How does it impact on you personally having that sort of oversight responsibility resting on your shoulders?
I'm very fortunate to have a lot of great people working for me. I trust what they do. They're very good at what they do. Ultimately, you know, that risk does sit with me. And I think personally, they're things that you think about, but you can't let them grind you into the ground because, like I said, there are risks involved in what we do in policing, and we take those risks to try and protect the greater good of society. So that's just part and parcel of what we have to do, and we'll continue to do that.
The last sort of question I want to explore with you a little bit is, when we're working internationally on a job like this, often we can be dealing with countries where our diplomatic relationship may not be in the best of shape. For example, at times, you know, in recent years, maybe with China, possibly France into the future. How does that impact on law enforcement when the diplomatic relationship is perhaps waning, but we've still got operational responsibilities and jobs we're pursuing?
It's definitely something we're very alive to. And like I said earlier, we're very fortunate to have such a significant and robust international network. And, you know, if I could sort of tackle the issue with China, you're right. Like, obviously, there are diplomatic strains at times with China. But I have to say that the AFP and the Chinese law enforcement officials actually work together in a task force that is in Guangzhou, and that has prevented in excess of 25 tons of illicit drugs coming to our country over the last 6 or 7 years. So interestingly to note that the only joint task force arrangement they have with any other law enforcement country in the world is with the AFP. And we're the envy of a lot of other foreign law enforcement agencies because of that very fact. And so, you know, the relationship that we have with the Chinese in that regard is actually very, very strong. So we'd sort of consider that as a part of police diplomacy. So it's interesting that even in times where, as countries from government to government, diplomatically, we may not get on, it's interesting that on a police-to-police basis, we don't see that effect as much.
Well, what do you think causes that? What may means that you continue to get on?
Well, it's a little bit easier in policing because our common enemy are criminals, and criminals don't respect borders. They're not constrained by some of the things that law enforcement are constrained by, nor countries in general. So I think it's just having that commonality that our common enemy are criminals, and our intent is to try and ensure that our citizens and citizens in other countries as well, that they're kept safe from threats that oppose from organised crime.
I understand that there's plans to make a movie about Operation Ironside. So I'm keen to understand how you feel about that. And then, of course, the obvious question to ask you is, who would you like to play you in that movie?
I'd like to think that the people who did all the hard work would get the credit for that sort of stuff rather than myself. And you're right, I'm not really that happy about having any sort of notoriety that is connected with that type of thing. But I did appear on the project when we went to Resolution, and Peter Hellier had asked me the same question. He said that he had a bit of a Matt Damon vibe about me, but I said that I was probably more likely to get an Australian contemporary actor with a dad bod and ask whether he was up for the job. So it has been the butt of a number of jokes, but I'll leave that to people much more creative and clever than I am to make those assessments.
Nigel, thank you so much for your time today and your work and your team's work in helping to make Australians safer. You've been listening to Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute team, with production support from Joss Gooding, and also thanks to Nigel's team at the AFP for helping put this together. See you next time.